It's the Nagging Naturalist Podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another minisode for the Egyptian fruit bat. Though, while this minisode will have some information that is pertinent to the Egyptian fruit bat, I'm actually going to talk more broadly about bats in this episode. This is called Ask the Nagging Naturalist, and this is basically where I take people's questions about the highlighted animal of the month and try my best to answer them, basically. Before I get into the episode, though, I do want to apologize in advance. I've had helicopters flying over all day, the neighbors' kids have been bouncing off the walls, and I have a cat that is literally snoring next to me right now. So I, of course, will try to edit out all the ambient noise, but if anything gets through in the end, I do apologize. I was pretty limited on when I could record, and so this is what's going on today. For this episode, I reached out to a group of educators who had some basic knowledge about bats but aren't necessarily bat experts, because I wanted to talk to them about bat adaptations, evolution, and their natural history. I didn't want to focus on myth-busting for this. There's tons of bat myth-busting all over the internet. Every year during Halloween, people do bat myth-busting. You can literally Google bat myths and you will find article after article telling you all kinds of things about bats. Because I didn't want to be redundant with my content, I wanted to focus on some questions that were more related to, like I said, that natural history. The first question I got was, who came first, the megabats or the microbats? Now, this is a bit of an odd question in some ways, just because sometimes that's not how evolution works. And at the same time, it's kind of interesting because I had somewhat of a similar question when I was first doing research about bats that I still hadn't answered, and this gave me the excuse to answer it, because my question was, what came first, flight or echolocation? Now, even though microbats do most of the echolocating, they are not the only ones that do it. The Egyptian fruit bat, their genus, and a few other megabats do possess a primitive form of echolocation. Their echolocation is completely different from microbat echolocation, which I always found fascinating. So technically, flight evolved once in bats, but echolocation evolved twice, once in microbats and once in megabats. But going back to my friend's question about who came first, megabats or microbats, I'm assuming that question was meant to be, were the common ancestors of the modern bats more on the insectivorous side or the frugivorous side? So megabats are typically frugivores that eat fruit, flowers, nectar, leaves, and things like that. You know, mainly herbivorous animals. There are some exceptions. It's not like when we apply these labels, it means that animals can't eat anything else. It usually just reflects what the majority of their diet is. Same goes with microbats. Microbats are predominantly insectivorous, so technically a type of carnivore. They eat insects. However, there are exceptions. And, you know, sometimes when animals are short on resources, they'll get crafty with what they have available, and they'll eat things that aren't normally part of their diet. That's how you survive. Based on what I was able to find, while nothing in particular points to the ancestors being overtly megabat or microbat, it does seem to lean in the direction of the microbat as far as their early ancestors go. Even though they began to develop limbs more for flight, bats' ancestors spent more time on the ground than they did flying initially, which is pretty common. And it seems that they were mostly insectivorous, so they were scrounging around on the ground for insects versus, you know, some ground-dwelling rodents that might scavenge fruit, nuts, and things like that. And I guess I should say that bats' common ancestors evolved about 50 to 60 million years ago. So this is just before the KT extinction or the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction. So this is the famous one that ended the era of the dinosaurs. So the first bats were evolving just before this major event happened and right before the big rise in mammals on this planet. So I guess in some ways it makes sense that the earlier bats were insectivores and more like the microbats, because the Cretaceous period is when flowering plants, or angiosperm, were first beginning to diversify because they had just evolved during the previous Triassic period. We didn't actually have plants with things like fruits and nuts until that time period. The earliest plants were mosses and ferns, and then later on we had gymnosperm, which is the conifers or evergreens. So there were some pretty limited resources back then. Now, of course, at this point, flowering plants have exploded in diversity, and so as that diversity would have grown, it would have given that niche to the eventual megabats that evolved. But after looking at the limited evidence I could find, and in my own consideration of how things were changing and evolving around the time that bats first began to come into this world, I would say that the earliest ancestors of bats were likely very close to what we would consider microbats, and that the megabats are a much more modern bat, given that their diet reflects a much more modern diversity than the microbats, who would have had access to a large variety of insects back in the Cretaceous period, because insects are far older than flowering plants are. Moving on to the next question, why can bats hang upside down without experiencing any negative side effects? Now, my personal understanding of this actually comes from a naturalist I met a while back who was doing a presentation about the work she does with bats. Somebody had asked a similar question of, you know, why can they hang upside down safely and it not impact them? She said that humans have mechanisms in their bodies, and by mechanisms I mean things like tendons and the way that our muscles and valves and stuff work in our bodies, that prevent blood from pooling in our legs and feet. Because if you think about it, gravity is constantly pulling things down, and so when blood pumps down to those parts of our body, pumping it back up towards the heart has to go against gravity. She said that in bats, that is flipped. So instead of having those mechanisms in their lower body, they have similar mechanisms that have been adapted in their heads. So they don't have to worry about blood rushing to their brains when they're upside down. They have those mechanics in their bodies that are going to keep their blood flowing, and it doesn't create those negative side effects. That's my understanding of why bats can safely hang upside down, was this talk that was given to me by this naturalist years ago. If anybody has anything else they want to add to that particular question, feel free to, but I personally think that that's a pretty cool answer, mostly because before she explained that, I never really thought about the fact that I need things in my legs and feet to keep blood from pooling there. I knew that our blood was kept pumping by a system of muscles and things and valves to make sure that it's always flowing. You know, we all learn the same things in high school, or at least I certainly hope we all learn the same things in high school about how our circulatory system works. But I don't think anybody consciously thinks about the fact that the system needs to be able to oppose gravity in order to function, because it has to go all the way down to our toes and back up. So I thought that was really cool. I learned something about my body. I learned something about bat bodies, and everybody walks away happy. The next question was, do bats poop on themselves while upside down? No. I've personally watched bats go to the bathroom. They have a pretty fast metabolism, similar to how birds do. They have very small bodies, and they process their food very quickly. When a bat needs to go, it will take its... So they hang upside down by their feet, but they, of course, have evolved their hands into their wings, but they still have use of their thumbs. So if you ever look at a picture of a bat's wings, you will sometimes see a little thing sticking up at the peak of the wings, and that's their thumb that is not fully integrated into the wing. So you can sometimes see this too when bats move around with their wings or latch onto things. You can see them using this little little phalanges sticking out of their wings, and that's their little thumbs. So they'll take their thumbs, they'll grab onto, you know, depending on what they're in, a tree or a cave, grab onto a surface, release their feet, which they've been hanging upside down with, so that their body flips. So now their heads are straight up. Some people would call it right side up, but I guess for a bat, it's not quite. But so they'll hang so that basically their bottoms are facing downwards and they can defecate without it going and running down their body. They're very hygienic animals. They do spend a lot of time grooming themselves. So it's not really surprising that bats would not want to just poop on themselves. I know some animals do it. It's mostly in the bird realm, though. Birds are gross. Sorry, team bird. But bats don't poop on themselves. And they will also defecate in flight as well. Now, some of the other questions I got are not always scientific. One question I got was, what are baby bats called? Baby bats are called pups. So if you didn't know that, now you know that bats have pups. Another question I got was, are bats migratory? Now, this is a good question because I know that it's not uncommon for some people to hear about bats hibernating, especially here in North America. A lot of our microbats hibernate because we do have winters where there's less resources available. And so in order to survive, they do have to go into a state of hibernation, just like bears do. And let me touch on that briefly before I answer the actual question. When we think of hibernation, we think of hibernation as this very long, deep sleep. And to a certain degree, it is, at least compared to human experiences. But hibernation is not necessarily a continuous sleep. Hibernation is a process that happens, and it does involve waking up. So, and this includes bears. Some bats will, of course, go into that state of hibernation where they slow down their bodily functions, they lower their body temperatures, their heart rate, their breathing. They conserve as much energy as possible. However, bats will wake up typically like every couple of weeks, roughly a month, and they'll move around and warm up and then shut themselves back off again. If we assume that bats are going to hibernate for, I guess if we were saying this 30 years ago, it would be different. Nowadays, they may not even be able to hibernate fully anymore because it's not getting cold enough. But let's say they're hibernating for about 3 to 4 months. That means they're going to wake up at least 3 to 4 times in that period, possibly more. So hibernation isn't necessarily this deep, dead sleep that some of us assume it is. It is simply a period of lowered activity in most animals. And not all animals hibernate. Some animals experience different things like torpor. So, you know, there are some animals that were like, oh, they're hibernating, they're sleeping for the winter. But they're not. They're experiencing a completely different process that requires different adaptations. Anyway, getting back to the original question, yes, there are migratory bats. It depends. So for a lot of our microbats, they do hibernate. And for species like the Egyptian fruit bat that lives typically in tropical and subtropical regions, it doesn't get cold enough and there's usually enough resources that they don't need to hibernate or migrate for the most part. But there are bats that do migrate. In fact, there is a massive migration that happens in the southwestern United States and Mexico. Now, sometimes the migration is daily. There are literally daily migrations that bats go through where they leave their large roost and they migrate miles and miles in order to find food. But there are also some seasonal migrations too. There are some bats that will leave regions to go to warmer places during the winter, and then we'll return in the springtime during the big burst of abundance that we get in northern and far southern regions during our springtimes. Migrating bats are the outliers in most cases, though. Most bats either hibernate or don't go anywhere. So migratory bats are the uncommon ones. So you're not going to hear about them as often as you will ones that hibernate or ones that live in tropical places and don't really have to worry about anything. Somebody asked me, what plant would I miss if bats weren't around to pollinate them? So there are very few plants where bats are the exclusive pollinators, but there are quite a few plants that we consider valuable that bats are the major pollinators of. So while other animals like birds and insects may contribute to it, bats are the ones that do most of the legwork. Some plants have developed what I mentioned in the first episode, that Chiroptera phylli, which is that affiliation with bats, that some plants have come to rely on them and actually evolve adaptations to attract bats. There are some plants that we may take for granted that rely almost exclusively on bats. So think of the very tropical fruits like bananas, mangoes, guava. Those are some of the fruits that we associate with that. Well, bananas, not so much. Bananas have become somewhat of a domestic fruit, even though they're not from North America. But things like mangoes and guavas have that, you know, very traditional nectary, citrusy flavor that we associate with, like, the tropics. And they rely very heavily on bat pollination to the point that they have adapted flowers that attract bats in particular. So as somebody who really likes tropical fruit flavors, especially when I was introduced to those infamous guava candies that people who've tried them know exactly what I'm talking about. They come in these little individual green wrappers. I love those flavors. I was introduced to those as a kid when I was living in Okinawa, Japan. And as an adult, like, I look forward to the summertime when ripe mangoes are available in the market. And my partner, he loves bananas. I would say that I would definitely be upset to lose those things. And I mentioned in the main episode of this month that bats are major pollinators for the agave plant, which we get things like tequila from. Or if you're not necessarily a drinker, but like the alternative sweeteners, agave syrup and sweeteners have become pretty popular in recent years because they're considered a healthy alternative to sugar and the artificial sweeteners. Finally, I had one last question, which I thought was a great question to ask because, to be honest, I don't talk about this enough. And that is, what is my favorite thing about bats? Now, I could list so many things. Their roles as pollinators and seed dispersers, or natural pest control for eating insects. There's a lot of things to love about bats. But for me, there's something really cute about bats. And I don't mean like the whole sky puppy thing. That's adorable too. But I don't know if people have ever thought of this, but I can't stop thinking about it now that I've seen one, because we used to have fruit bats at my aquarium. But bats have belly buttons, people. Remember, they're mammals, they have umbilical cords in the womb, and they have belly buttons. And if you ever actually notice a bat's belly button, I mean, it depends on the bat. Usually it's easier to see when they're younger and they don't quite have as much fur, but they just, in my opinion, they just have really adorable belly buttons. And if you've never seen a bat belly button, I hope you look for one the next time you look at a picture of a young bat, because it's adorable. They have just these little bumps, little owies that are their belly buttons, and it's so precious. And I should probably be talking about all the amazing benefits of bats, but to be honest, I've said that in my last episodes, so I feel like I can be a little frivolous with my answer and just admit that I think bat belly buttons are adorable. So that's all I have this week. I just wanted to answer a couple of those questions because I felt like they were really good gateway questions to talking about some cool adaptations for bats. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me. A lot of you probably know the drill by now. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to reach out to my email, thenaturalist@thenaggingnaturalist.com, and you can check out my website, thenaggingnaturalist.com. I'm also on social media. You can find The Nagging Naturalist on Facebook and Instagram, as well as Twitter under the handle @nag_naturalist. Thank you all so much for listening in this week, and stay tuned for next week with the final episode of the month to learn more about this wonderful world of wildlife.